Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang it in there.
Because
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me as always is a man who is just dying to tell Joe Rogan that he's been abducted by aliens twice. He is the Captain.
All the small things. It's good to be seen and it's good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
Today we are drinking Lonesome Boatman Ale by the brilliant guys and girls over at the Outer Light Brewing Company over in Connecticut. Garage grade 4 out of 5 bottle caps.
The Lonesome Boatman was my best friend at sea.
Well, Lonesome Boatman Ale is a red ale. It's a very complex red ale. Bready, toasty, and hoppy. But the thing I noticed first is this is a very high quality and balanced red ale, perfect for the colder months.
He was a gentleman's gentleman.
And we were able to warm up to this Outer Light brew thanks to Sarah in Benbrook, Texas.
And a big shout out to Leslie in St. Louis Park, Minnesota.
Next, we have Cynthia from Janesville, Wisconsin, who says she gives the garage 5 stars.
Hey, to all of our friends donating to the beer fund, I give you 5 stars. And a big we like your jib to Kelly and Port Moody, British Columbia.
And last but not least, we have Jenna in Nashville, Tennessee. So thanks to everybody for going to the website and helping out the garage. If you want to fill up the fridge for next week's show, go to truecrimegarage.com, click on the donate button.
And only a couple days left to get your Parts Unknown pre-order t-shirts. Get your order in today or you're just going to be locked out of Parts Unknown forever.
So let it be known that time is running out for Parts Unknown, right, Captain? That's enough of the business. Everybody gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. In the early morning hours of July 23rd, 2007, two men broke into the home of Dr. William Pettit. Pettit had lived at the home on Sorghum Mill Drive in the quiet, safe town of Cheshire, Connecticut for 20 years. At home with Dr. Pettit that night was his wife and 2 daughters. The two men found Dr. Pettit asleep on a couch in the sunroom. They beat him with a baseball bat. From there, the two men went on to ransack the house and terrorize the girls. This is the nightmarish story of a home invasion and murder. Dr. Pettit's wife, Jennifer, and 2 daughters, 17-year-old Haley and 11-year-old Michaela, were killed by these two men. A few days later, at the memorial services for the 3 victims, Jennifer Pettit and her daughters, Haley and Michaela, over 4,000 people were present. People came in from several states away. All 3 were buried in white caskets per Bill's request. And somehow Bill, still nowhere near having recovered from the physical attack he had been subjected to, somehow Bill he had the strength to speak at that service. Now let's go back to Monday, July 23rd, because right after the vehicle stolen by these two men, Jennifer's van, had crashed into two police cars. The police thankfully arrested those men, right? So now we have these two guys in custody. The police arrested Joshua Karmasiewski. He's younger than his partner in crime, Stephen Hayes, by about 20 years. The two of them, they shared the same set of issues. Both of these guys are career criminals. They're in and out of trouble for most of their adult lives. They both have problems with alcohol and drugs. Now, both these guys up to this point were guilty of having committed pretty much just petty crimes, you know, breaking into cars, stealing cars. That was Stephen Hayes' thing. Within hours of the arrest, Stephen Hayes was ready to confess and tell the police just what went down, the how and the why. Now, according to Stephen Hayes, the two men, he and Joshua, had met at a halfway house and became friends of sorts. Hayes would typically commit crimes to feed his alcohol and drug problems, but he was looking to, quote unquote, step up his game. He wanted to start breaking into homes because he was under the impression that you will find more money and more valuables, especially if you go and pick out a nice home and watch it for a while. Anyway, Joshua is a pro at breaking into homes. As a matter of fact, that is like his specialty. He's been arrested many times for breaking into homes.
Yeah, and I think when he was arrested one time, he claimed that he broke into 18 different homes.
Mm-hmm. So Joshua starts showing his new friend Stephen Hayes how to pick out a good house, how to break in, what to look for, all that sort of stuff, right? In fact, just the day before they broke into the Pettit's home, the two had broken into several homes. Stephen Hayes was learning new criminal skills, and Joshua now, with the help of a partner, was scheming other ways to increase the score. Plus, it's widely believed that he wanted to start committing other types of crimes rather than just B&E and burglary.
One of the questions becomes, why did they pick the Pettit family?
Well, we have a situation, Captain, where late in the afternoon on Sunday, July 22nd, 48-year-old Jennifer Hawk Pettit, she's with her 11-year-old daughter, Michaela. They went to that Stop and Shop grocery store in Cheshire. Now, during their trip to the grocery store, somehow they attracted the attention of Joshua Karmasiewski, who followed them home. He mm-hmm. was there waiting for somebody. He said something like,
A contractor
was supposed to pay him some money or something like that. But anyway, he sees the woman and her child at the store. It seems like he may have had some attraction to the child.
He definitely did.
Yeah. And he decides to follow them to their home, where he notices that they live in a nice neighborhood in a big house.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he says, quote, "It looked like a nice place to be someday."
Yeah.
Stephen Hayes would tell us that Joshua told him that he had liked the way the 11-year-old girl looked. Stephen Hayes messages Joshua. He sends him a text message saying, "Hey, I'm chomping at the bit to get started. Need a margarita soon."
Mm.
To which he gets no reply from Joshua. Stephen Hayes then texts later saying, "We still on?" question mark. Joshua replies, "Yes." Stephen Hayes wants to know if it will be soon. And Joshua answers, "I'm putting the kid to bed. Hold your horses." Stephen Hayes then wrote, "Dude, the horses want to get loose. LOL." At some point, the two men get together that evening, and they decide to go out to a bar. And they're having several drinks. I'm guessing what they're doing is they're planning their attack.
Mm-hmm.
Because Joshua is telling him about this home that he has become aware of, that he followed these two people home from the Stop and Shop grocery store, and he liked their house. It was a big house. There was probably lots of valuables in there. According to Hayes' confession, the two men had planned to rob the Pettit home under cover of darkness, leaving the family bound but unharmed. The men got into the home through the cellar door. Remember the cellar door that leads down into their basement from right. their backyard. The lock on this door was broken. It actually had been broken for quite some time.
Yeah, but this is also a neighborhood at that time. A lot of people didn't lock all their doors.
Mm-hmm. And the cellar basement stairs, once inside, would lead up to the Pettit family's kitchen. This door, too, had a lock on it, so you could lock it from the kitchen side.
Mm-hmm.
However, this lock was not locked that night, and it wasn't common practice for anyone in the Pettit family to lock this door. Well, after creeping in through the cellar door, through the basement, and up the stairs, they eventually found William Pettit sleeping on a couch. Some people call this the porch. It's more of a sunroom. Now, Bill says he never heard the men approaching him. He actually didn't wake up until Josh struck him in the head with the baseball bat. Josh had found the baseball bat. There's several accounts of this. Most of them saying that it was lying in the yard, somewhere in the backyard. There is an account or two that said they may have found it in the basement. Then tying Bill up at gunpoint and later moving him to the basement. The children and their mother were bound and locked in their respective rooms. Stephen Hayes said that he and Karma Sajewski were not satisfied with the amount of money or valuables that they found in the home, and that was when the bank book was discovered, which showed that big available balance that we discussed. Stephen Hayes went and he purchased the gas, the gasoline in those two jugs.
About 7 o'clock.
He actually got lost on his way back to the home, driving around more than necessary. He was communicating with Joshua either by way of text or phone calls or both to try to find his way back to the Pettit home, which, of course, we know he ultimately did.
Mm-hmm.
He unloaded the gas, and then he drove Mrs. Pettit to the Bank of America. He mostly drove around. You had said yesterday that she was in there longer than he had expected, and I think this probably made him nervous knowing that there would be some type of cameras or possible surveillance outside of the bank. So he was driving around maybe to hide his identity a little bit better. But during this time, Joshua, still back at the house, he severely escalated the nature of the crimes that would be committed. Stephen Hayes says that when he returned with Mrs. Pettit and the money back to the house, that Joshua had told him that he had sexually assaulted the 11-year-old girl that was locked in her room upstairs. He said that Joshua provoked Stephen Hayes into raping Mrs. Pettit. While Hayes was raping her on the floor of the living room, Joshua entered the room at some point and announced that Bill Pettit had escaped the house.
Yeah, but let's be clear about this because, you know, when they're first arrested, you know, Josh is coming out right away saying, my name is, you know, Josh. There's these, you know, here's the people that are in the house. When Stephen is arrested, he doesn't give them the name. He doesn't basically cooperate at all. Within hours, they're both kind of turning on each other.
Mm-hmm.
This is just shows you what kind of horrible pieces of shit these people are when they say, oh, well, he provoked me to rape the mother. Yeah, you could have just said no.
Mm-hmm.
You got gasoline because you were worried about fingerprints and DNA. So you knew you're going to torch this house.
Yeah.
They go back and forth with their stories and they're constantly like, you know, it seems like most of the time they're telling the truth. And then there's these little tiny gray areas where they start putting the blame on the other individual. And I think this is one of them. Oh, he provoked me.
Yeah. I mean, we have this situation where Stephen is saying that the plan was to just get rid of the fingerprints, that we just need to hide evidence that we probably unknowingly left within the home.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could get this gasoline, we could ransack the house, we could get the money from the bank, and then we could tie this family up, move them elsewhere, and torch the house with the gasoline.
Right, and what he's saying is because Josh escalated it by raping the daughter, that's the reason why they had to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
You knew that they saw your face anyways.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a possibility that they knew that they were going to get rid of this family, you know, all along.
And Stephen says once he's told by Joshua that Bill Pettit had escaped the home from the basement, that he strangled Jennifer and then doused her lifeless body and then other parts of the house with that gasoline, including the daughter's rooms, while they're still tied to their beds. Both of the daughters had been doused with gasoline, each with her head, with their heads still covered with these pillowcases. Fire was started, and Stephen Hayes and Joshua Karmasajewski fled the scene. Haley and Michaela both died from smoke inhalation.
They were burned to death, and the oldest one, there were signs that she actually got up. So she was alive while she's being set on fire.
And as we said, the two suspects fleeing the home, they're immediately spotted by police, pursued and arrested just one block away from the home. The whole home invasion lasted roughly 7 hours. Both men smelled strongly of gasoline during the interrogation process. Detectives noted this. Each of the two lowlifes, as you had said, blamed or implicated the other as the mastermind and or driving force behind the sexual assaults and the killing spree. There were even attempts at times to blame the husband and father, Bill Pettit, as some type of accomplice.
Yeah, and that was kind of the rumor in town. When you have a whole family that is murdered the way they are, and the husband gets free, I think a lot of people assumed that maybe he had something to do with it.
On September 13th, 2010, this is how long it takes, Captain, to get to the first trial in this situation.
Well, but there's some stuff to talk about before the first trial. I mean, both individuals, both of these low-life pieces of shit, they say, hey, look, we will tell you everything. We'll plead guilty. You know, just give us life in prison with no possibility of parole. That was their first thing that they did. And for whatever reason, the state decided that that wasn't enough.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because there's a lot of media regarding how this came about. There's a lot of people saying that Dr. Pettit, that Bill Pettit was the driving force, saying we have to sentence these guys to death.
Well, because there was a bill going to be passed and they're going to get rid of the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
They basically state, because of this case and because of the horrific nature of this case, that we're going to, I think the governor vetoed it, and they said, okay, well, now that bill is vetoed for right now, and now we're going to go to trial.
Bill Pettit would say that, you know, he never argued, never fought the prosecutors on this, but it was the prosecutors that had given the recommendation to him that we go after the death penalty. And we don't need to get into a whole death penalty debate or anything like that, but...
Well, that's what this case becomes, aftermath of it, and... The fact of the matter is, I mean, I think, okay, I'm just going to say this because this is kind of what I believe. I mean, none of these details and none of this stuff has to come out in public, and you don't have to spend money on this stuff. These guys are going to plead guilty. They're going to spend the rest of their lives in jail. They're not going to go to regular jail. They're going to go to solitary confinement. It's basically like being buried alive, and these guys are going to have to live with their actions for the rest of their lives. Also, in the meantime, before the trial happened, I believe both of them tried to take their own lives.
Yeah.
So these guys want to die, you know? And so you're going to go after the death penalty? That's kind of what they want. So why would you give these animals what they want? Lock them in a cage, have them deal with their actions and what they did. And they'll have to think about that every day. The other problem that I have with this case is that once you go to trial, now all these details have to be relived. And some of these details weren't known because the cops and the media, the cops weren't sharing this with the media because they didn't have to. They have confessions. And so to me, you know, it's like you can protect them after their death by not having to relive this or not have to put this information onto the public.
Yeah, but there's clearly no right answer here. You know, you can make a strong argument for either situation that they should be, they should just let them confess and give them life in prison or have the state kill them. You can make a strong argument for either one. I think in this situation, whatever the sole survivor of the home invasion wants to go after. And if the prosecutors...
Yeah, but that doesn't make it right just because he was the sole survivor.
It doesn't make it wrong, though, either.
I think there is a right and wrong answer here.
Okay.
I mean, I think one, I don't know if we should get into this right now, but the state spent over $7 million trying to prosecute these guys. And then Stephen has now asked to be sent to death, and they're still appealing it. He's like, hey, go ahead, kill me. I want to die. I don't want to live with what I did. And the state's still going, no, we're still going to have appeals. We're going to still spend more and more money on this. I don't know how that makes any sense.
Okay. Well, I don't want to put a dollar amount on seeking justice for victims of horrible crimes.
That's how's that seeking any justice? I mean, the big question here becomes, when did the cops know about this, and what could the cops done to possibly prevent this? I mean, they weren't dousing the house with gasoline until they got back. And within probably 30 seconds of them returning back home, police were on the scene. You know, so they had the house surrounded. That becomes the big question. I think that's a moot argument to say, well, I'm putting a price on justice. You know, what is justice? That's what these killers wanted. They wanted to die. So isn't that giving them what they wanted? And is that justice?
I would rather give Bill what he wants. I don't care what these two guys want. Anyway, at the first trial, September 13th.
Right, but what you're saying doesn't make any sense, because what Bill wants and what the killers want are the same thing.
It does make sense. How does it not make sense? I'm saying that the guy that had to live through this nightmare, that every day has to wake up without his wife and his two children, if he wants these guys killed, I'm fine with it. That's what I'm saying. I'm fine with it.
Right.
And it doesn't matter what Stephen Hayes or Joshua Karmaszewski, guys who have lied and manipulated people their entire lives, say that they want. I don't care. I don't care what they want.
Right, but what
this
they
is
want
not
is,
about them. Right, this but is what, not about them
yeah,
at
but,
all.
But once you go to trial, once you go seeking the death penalty, then guess what it becomes about? It becomes about them. Because now we have to argue, you know, why did they do this? What made them this way? And so the whole trial becomes about the horrific stuff that they did to your family. And then it becomes about these two individuals. And if you would have just taken the plea deal and you just would have locked them up for the rest of their lives, we wouldn't be talking about this now.
We wouldn't?
I don't think so.
I mean, this is a home invasion with three murders. This is one of the most publicized home invasion murder cases in the state of Connecticut.
Yeah, and one of the main reasons it's so publicized is because they went to trial and sought the death penalty.
Okay, let's get to the first trial, because we could debate this all night. We have the first trial. It takes till September of 13th of 2010 to take place. Now, unfortunately, Bill had to sit just about 10 feet from one of the men who had killed his family. At the very start of the trial, the defense for Stephen Hayes simply stated that everything the state says Hayes did, he is guilty of. He broke into the Pettit home, watched his partner beat Mr. Pettit with a baseball bat. He tied up the girls, purchased the gasoline, drove Mrs. Pettit to the bank to get the money, returned her to the home, raped Jennifer Pettit, and strangled her. He then followed Josh as the two perpetrators fled the home, knowing it was in flames and that three persons were tied up and still alive. At least two, possibly three people tied up and still alive in the home. So this trial was not going to be to decide if Stephen Hayes was guilty. Now, this trial would simply decide how Stephen Hayes is going to be punished. Would he get sentenced to life in prison, or would he get the death sentence? Attorney Thomas Ullman told the jury, this is Hayes's attorney, told the jury that a sentence of life in prison would be the harshest possible punishment for his client because he was so tormented by his crimes and would be isolated in prison, stating life in prison without the possibility of release is the harshest penalty. It is a fate worse than death. If you want to end his misery, put him to death. If you want him to suffer and carry that burden forever, the guilt and humiliation, sentence him to life without the possibility of release.
Yeah, and one of the things like I said before, he tried to kill himself. And one of the reasons was he kept on having these reoccurring nightmares that, you know, Stephen had a daughter, and in his nightmare, his daughter was burning alive, and he would have this dream over and over.
Yeah, there were several complications with his trial. One, like you said, the suicide attempt. I guess he was pilfering away the drugs. Maybe some of this.
Yeah, I think that was his second attempt.
Yeah, he was pilfering away these pills for quite some time, saving them up so he could take a whole bunch of them at once and attempt to kill himself. And then he also had some health issues throughout the course of the trial that may have slowed it down a bit. It came out in Stephen's trial that, according to the medical examiner, an unspeakable act had been committed on 11-year-old Michaela. Joshua Karmaszewski had sodomized the little girl. This was new information that further shocked the public, and the poor family had to hear this information in person at the trial of Stephen Hayes. Joshua had admitted to assaulting the girl orally, but not this. The jury also learned that the police had found pornographic pictures on Joshua's cell phone that were presumably taken by Joshua during the time that he was assaulting the little girl. The pictures showed Michaela naked and tied to her bed, and showed Joshua's genitalia as well in the pictures.
Yeah, and this happened when Stephen left to get the gas around 7 o'clock.
There was more than one assault, however you look at Stephen Hayes' story. Also presented at this trial were the journals of Joshua, in which he referred to his breaking into homes as extreme sport. In his diary, he chose to call Bill Pettit a coward and claimed that Bill could have stopped the murders had he wanted to. He said that Jennifer, the mother and wife, was brave, and that Haley, the oldest daughter, was a fighter. And again, he said Bill was a coward. The man he had beat over the head multiple times with a baseball bat. I mean, it's just ridiculous that he would refer to Mr. Pettit as a coward. I mean, we have Stephen Hayes. Stephen Hayes says in his confession, he says that Josh hit Mr. Pettit in the front and back of the head with the bat as hard as he could. Now, this is a man that most certainly was threatened with a gun. Quote, remember the quote, if he moves, put two bullets in him. A man that had lost over 7 pints of blood, that was slipping in and out of consciousness. A man that was beaten and bound and had to hope and pray that the men that had beaten him were being honest when they told him they were only there for the money and then they would leave. And these same dirtbags told Mrs. Pettit, if you go to the bank and get us the money, we will leave. And instead, she was not rewarded for doing this. Not rewarded for doing what they said at all. She was punished for doing what they had said. Stephen Hayes ultimately was found guilty on 16 of 17 counts related to the home invasion murders. Now, on October 5th, 2010, is when he was found guilty. In early November, the jury returned with a recommendation for him to be executed. He was sentenced to death. The jury chose to show him no mercy. He was seeking mercy as he's claiming, you know, he had a pretty bad drug problem at this time. He's also saying, you know, I offered a confession to the police. I told them everything that I knew, but they would show him no mercy. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
If you're thinking of starting therapy, I highly recommend that you give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/garage today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/garage. This show is proudly sponsored by BetterHelp. Check out betterhelp.com/garage today.
The best part of spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity you get. It's kind of like when you find out that you've been paying a fortune for wireless. When Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. It's time to switch to Mint Mobile. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. Save a lot of money with Mint Mobile. Get their great mobile wireless service delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. That's premium service at a great price. To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Everyone loves a good family mystery, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey, a hidden object mystery game with a captivating detective story. It takes you back to the glamour of the 1920s with a diverse cast of characters. You'll step into the role of June Parker and search for hidden clues to uncover the mystery of her sister's murder. Use your observation skills to quickly uncover key pieces of information that lead to chapters of mystery, danger, and romance. And customize your very own luxurious estate island. Think expansive gardens and beautiful buildings. Collect scraps of information to fill your photo album and learn more about each character. And you can chat and play with or against other players by joining a detective club. Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic Raised Bed and Garden Soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.
All right, we're back. Cheers, mates. We're back from punching each other in the face.
Cheers to you, Captain. On December 2nd, 2010, Stephen Hayes, he apologized for the pain and suffering he had caused the Pettit family and added that death for me will be a welcome relief, and I hope it will bring some peace and comfort to those who I have hurt so much. Now, Judge John Blue formally imposed 6 death sentences, one for each of the capital charges. Blue then added a sentence of 106 years for other crimes that Stephen Hayes committed during the home invasion. And before he finished, he stated this. He stated, "This is a terrible sentence, but is in truth a sentence you wrote for yourself in flames. May God have mercy on your soul." Now, just as the captain had mentioned, Stephen Hayes had attempted to negotiate a life sentence during a plea bargain, and that did not happen. After the verdict, his defense attorney stated Hayes smiled upon hearing the jury's recommendation of a death sentence. He added, "He is thrilled. He is very happy with the verdict. That is what he wanted all along."
Basically, they're going, "Hey, we're going for appeals." And he's like, "I don't want to appeal. I want to die now." Mm-hmm. So again, like I said, I know that's what Bill wanted, but it's also what the killers wanted.
Now, there was a second trial. We have to try Joshua Karmaszewski for this. He was born in 1980 to a 16-year-old girl and a 20-year-old mechanic and was later adopted by Benedict Karmaszewski. Joshua was a very similar setup, let's say. You know, we have this situation where you're caught red-handed, so it's more of a trial of, is he going to get life or death? Joshua was basically begging the jury and the court for mercy. His biological parents had a history of mental illness, and Joshua grew up in a home where he was molested. When he was about 4 years old, his adopted parents brought in a 15-year-old foster kid who raped Joshua and put cigarettes out on him. When Joshua was older, he ended up molesting his little sister. It's a little unclear how much knowledge the parents had of both of these situations, but it seems like at some point during his childhood, they had some type of knowledge.
Yeah.
And then choosing to deal with these situations themselves rather than to involve the authorities or any type of counseling.
What angers me is that this guy gets his day in court to basically, you know, justify why he did what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but these claims, you know, originally when they made these claims, I thought, well, this is probably just a bunch of, you know, horse shit, right?
Yeah.
But the kid was 14 at the time, the foster kid. He admits to it. He apologizes, but it seems like this family always turned to religion. So instead of going to the authorities or anything like that, okay, well, you know, homosexuality is wrong and we're going to put this kid and we're going to push religion onto him. And I think that's one of the reasons why, how do I say this, that he was attracted to younger females, probably because of the abuse.
Okay.
But didn't turn to males because of the condemning nature of the church.
Of his religion, yes.
Right.
Just to be clear, in case it confuses anybody, we're telling the story here. And the story is that the situation is this. Homosexuality is wrong according to Joshua's church, to the church that he attended at the time, not according to the captain or the colonel or Nick or however many people are in the garage here. But now, like we saw in the first trial, Captain, mm-hmm. With Joshua's journal coming out that stating, you know, Bill Pettit was a coward. We see this again in the second trial where Josh is now saying he claimed that he believed that Bill Pettit could have escaped earlier. He claimed that the zip ties and the rope were loose enough that Bill could have wiggled his way out at any time. His lawyer, Joshua's lawyer, also argued that for his client to be sentenced to death, the victims that were murdered had to have died in a cruel manner. Now, their argument is because two of the girls, here's their argument. This is going to make you want to
vomit.
You thought you and I got into it earlier with the back and forth. This is going to make you want to kick a hole through the garage door here.
Done and done.
Okay, so the argument is this, that Stephen Hayes killed the mother, right? So you have to take that one off the table when you have Joshua on trial. So he should only technically be charged with killing two people. And they're stating these two girls, their cause of death is technically listed as smoke inhalation. The smoke inhalation is described, and this was forced to be described by Josh's lawyer. He had the medical experts, explain what typically happens when somebody dies of smoke inhalation. Well, their argument is that the way the experts described this did not particularly mean that it was a cruel manner in which these two girls were killed. Of course, they purposely failed to mention the hours of traumatizing the girls, the little one raped, both doused with gasoline, and like you said, were on fire and surrounded by flames as they died. There were some details that were learned in the trial regarding that night, as the two men had some troubles with 17-year-old Haley. Remember Joshua's journal had said that she was a fighter.
Yeah.
Both the men had ripped landline phones out of the walls once they took over the home. Well, at least once, I believe possibly twice, they caught Haley with her cell phone or someone else's cell phone attempting to either notify someone or possibly call 911. On October 13th, 2011, Josh Karmaszewski was convicted on all 17 counts. On January 27th, 2002, Judge John Blue sentenced him to death by lethal injection, to which his sentence became an automatic life sentence, as did Stephen Hayes's when eventually Connecticut abolished the death penalty. This took place in 2015. Now, both Hayes and Karmaszewski are housed in separate prison facilities in the state of Pennsylvania to serve out their life sentences.
Yeah, and I think this is the part, you know, that makes me so mad about this case. Why did this information have to come to light in public? You know, why did they veto the bill for the death penalty just to have this trial? And then once they have the trial, then they basically put that, they passed the law anyways. You know, it seems like wasted time, wasted money, wasted hurt. You know, I don't know.
Well, to be fair to you, Captain, I think as with all of us, this is just one of many aspects of this case that make us all very angry and upset with everything. I mean, there's just no way to feel good about any of this, regardless of what type of sentence or punishment these two monsters end up getting in the end.
Right. And HBO made a documentary about this. And when I was watching it, towards the end of it, and they're talking about Josh's trial and what happened to him as a kid. I mean, I think that's what really frustrated me the most. And what made me so angry is these guys are horrible individuals. And I don't want to know why they got that way. And I don't want to feel sorry for him at all. But when you hear the stuff that happened to this kid, somebody helped create a monster. Was he going to be that way? Would this happen without that? I don't know. Whatever you think is justice, whether it's the death penalty or just rot in jail, I just want that to happen. But I don't want to look at him as a victim. And I think by giving him the day in court, you have to examine those things.
Yeah, and this was unique because for the first time in the state's history, the Connecticut State Judicial Branch offered post-traumatic stress assistance to people who served on the juries of these two triple murder trials because they had been required to look at disturbing images and hear ghastly testimony. There were several parts during both trials where there were pictures that were not shown to the public, to the people that just showed up to witness the trials. There were many, obviously many images that were shown to these people. However, when it came to the jury, there were several times during these trials where they took a manila envelope, you know, one of them file folders, and they put in it whatever horrible graphic image that somebody had taken a picture of, whether it was a picture Joshua had taken on his cell phone or whether it was police and firefighter photographs during the investigation itself. And they had to pass these folders along. And, you know, the one reporter wrote that every time that these file folders were brought to the jury, I mean, you could see it on their faces. It was as simple as this. It was handed to one juror. He or she would open up the folder,
Right. Look
at the thing for a second or two, close it and hand it to the next person. And the reporter said that anytime this happened in these trials, that's all you could hear in the entire courtroom. Everyone was silent. Yeah. And all you could hear was the flapping open of this file folder, somebody having to see something no one should ever have to see.
Well, they had to take multiple breaks because of this.
Yes, and pass it along to the next person. And of course, the family, the Pettit family, they had to sit there and hang their heads when this happened as well.
The victims, these three angels of humans, You know, they're the victims, right. not these animals. But you give them their day in court, and like I said, you have to examine that stuff that happened to them as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's two monsters pleading for mercy. They didn't show anybody any mercy that night, so I'm glad that 24 people decided not to show them any mercy, as well as the judge. The aftermath of this thing, I mean, is huge, but I did want to touch upon a few things. Bill Pettit established the Michaela Rose Pettit Scholarship Fund for the Chase Collegiate School. He also established the Haley's Hope and Michaela's Miracle MS Memorial Fund. There were several organizations and foundations that have been set up because of Bill Pettit and because of people close to this case trying to do a lot of good for because a lot of bad happened.
Yeah.
In August of 2012, Bill Pettit married. He got remarried, and eventually they went on to, him and his new wife went on to have, I believe, a son. So some kind of form of healing for Bill.
Yeah, and they actually tore down the Pettit family home,
mm-hmm.
and they turned that into a memorial garden. I really like what one of the grandparents said, is that if closure means anything of forgetting, then I don't want any closure.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was good, because, you know, the thing is that these the three beautiful souls, they were trying to do good in the world, and who knows what, you have a young daughter that raised over $50,000 for MS.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Yeah, I mean, they were the three girls were good in every sense of the word. I mean, all three of them. And here's one thing I also want to touch upon too, Captain, is, you know, I've heard people say, and I think this is a fantastic quote, that one's character is best judged in a time of tragedy. And the way that the Bill Pettit and his parents and the family members of, you know, the Hawk family and Jennifer Pettit's family, the way that they carried themselves, presented themselves, and their humanity through this whole thing, to me, it was amazing how well they were able to carry themselves and hold themselves together,
yeah.
during and remain civilized in a situation that none of us can imagine and should never have to imagine going through. Now, Bill Pettit, he has not returned to his medical practice since the murders, stating that his desire is to be active in the foundation set up to honor the memory of his deceased family.
Right.
He now serves as a state representative. The other thing, too, regarding him not returning to his medical practice, we have to keep in mind the injuries that he sustained during that, and the type of, you know, he's got to have a clear mind. Mm-hmm. He's got to have steady hands. He has to be able to think on his feet because of his job. And he has said that the injuries he sustained and the loss emotionally, mentally, his heart is broken, that he's no longer able to be of sound mind and be somebody that's able to care for his patients in the way that they deserve to be.
Yeah, when you go through that, a tragic like that, or a tragic loss like that, you have to figure out why care to go on. And that's what he had to figure out.
One final thought for me, Captain, is Joshua Karmaszewski. He called Bill Pettit a coward. And personally, I can't think of a more sick and cowardly act than raping a child. Joshua Karmaszewski is a child rapist. He had a daughter of his own, and there may have been one possibly good thing that could have come of this. I believe he would have eventually, if he hadn't already, I believe he would have raped his own daughter, and very likely many times. That's what he is. That's what Joshua Karmaszewski is. He's a child rapist, and he, in fact, is the coward. Bill Pettit, because of cowards like Joshua Karmaszewski and Stephen Hayes, He chose to speak at the funeral and two trials for his wife and two daughters. And on those days, Bill, William Pettit was more of a man than I have ever been asked to be, and more brave than I could ever imagine to be.
One thing that we should touch on, because if we don't, we'll probably get some hate mail, is the reaction from the cops and how they handled this situation. There has been some criticism from the Hawk family.
Yeah, and I get it. I get it. I don't know that I... here's the problem. I'm able to sit here in the garage with you, you know, and have a good time with you. And
not today, my friend.
Yeah, today's been aggravating, but it's because of the case, not because of you, not because of anything outside of this.
You.
But I'm lucky. I'm able to sit here and have a beer and relax and talk about this thing that happened 10 years ago.
Right.
And so you'd think my mind would be clear. More clear than what it is, that I should have a hard stance on these different opinions, but I don't. What I see is a crime that took 6 or 7 hours to commit that broke a lot of people. It broke the family members, and it broke the community. The thing here is you have a situation where I think in a good number of ways, the police were just following protocol. They were setting up a perimeter. They were trying to, you know, they have to keep the peace. And if that means trapping it with inside those four walls,
right,
sometimes that's what they have to do. And as you and I both agreed on, they don't fully know the situation as to what's going on inside those four walls. I agree with the people that are angry at the police. Right. And here's what I mean by that. I agree that they're angry. Because I, too, am angry. I just don't know that the police are the right people to be angry at. I think that this case is one of these ones that just rips your heart out. And the problem is when you have these two lowlifes who get life sentences or committed to death, whatever, mm-hmm. regardless of what they end up getting, you're still angry. You're still mad and you're still upset. And at some point, you need more to blame than just these two guys, because this just seems too horrible for only two people to be responsible for.
Right.
And so that's when, you know, when you see the Hawk family upset with the police, I agree with them. And I think you have to let them vent. I don't know what could have been done differently. I know that Bill has never publicly blame the police for any misdoings.
Yeah, you want to talk about being courageous. I mean, here's the individual that he feels, you know, he lost all this blood and he still feels that he should have went up the different stairs instead of going outside, that he should have went into the kitchen. And I think he blames himself a little bit and he's probably angry. And I guarantee you these cops, this law enforcement team, now knowing what they know, I guarantee you they're angry mm-hmm. with some of their decisions. Put yourself in their shoes. You don't know what's happening. You're trying to assess the situation. These cops did not want this to take place. I guarantee you that every single one of them wishes that they could have stopped it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that they're angry, and I'm sure that they blame themselves, and there's no reason for more people to point the finger at them.
Hey, one thing I want to point out to all the great garage people out there is that we have our blog that's active on truecrimegarage.com. A lot of these cases, you know, we cover so many cases, a new one every week. A lot of times we are asked if we could do an update and things like that.
Yeah.
The blog is a running update of all those cases. And the great thing is that everybody out there gets to contribute to that blog and to that information. You can participate by reading or writing your own comment there. I do want to throw one thing in here, please, Captain.
Silence.
He shut it down just like that. regarding this case, let's not get into a whole pro against death penalty debate on the blog. We will refrain from doing that, but certainly leave your other thoughts there at truecrimegarage.com. A lot of interesting conversation going on regarding the Kanika Jenkins case, the Delphi case. All these cases still very active, so check out that information there.
Yeah, you can speculate if we're left or right wing, but we'll never tell you because this is not a political show. So,
what I can tell you, Captain, is that this case has made me so very angry, and I'm very lucky and thankful to have a whole big bowl of leftover candy bars from last night, and I will use that entire bowl to comfort myself.
Well, I'm going to use...
I'm and get use, me through this troubling moment.
I'm going to use a thing called bourbon. So, all right. Thanks for sharing on social media. Thanks for supporting the show. We would be nothing without you. We'll see you again next week. Have a happy Halloween.
And until next week, be good, be kind, and don't litter.
I was shocked, you know? They were always such a good team, so successful. But to do something like that? To exceed their budget?
While being over budget might not be a crime, it can disrupt workflows. With Monday.com, you and the team can be sure that you're all in sync. All the data, latest updates, files, and budgets are visible to everyone, so you won't miss a thing. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.